when it comes to things that have been overlooked, I might suggest that aside from everything we're discussing here today and in future episodes, we have documentation to back up what we're saying. We're not just pulling this stuff out of our butts and making our stuff up. We don't do that. Mm-hmm. But people in official sworn testimony before the Senate Select Committee made things up and actually gave false testimony. So that's why we're doing these podcasts, mm-hmm. to let it be known out there for people who have no clue of what we know exists because we possess it, is contradicting the official Department of Defense file case.
He just turned 20 when his chopper went down and searched for survivors. He wasn't found. He was missing in action and still is today. His buddies came back, but he had to stay. He can't remember a day without pain.
When you see the excerpts from the Senate Select Committee testimony by Mr. Bob Sheets explaining that there were no survival beacons received, here are the secret documents, declassified such as they are, that just tell you that Bob Sheets was saying things that, and this is sworn testimony, by the way, to the Senate Select Committee, to which Senator Smith just went off on him. He could not believe what he was hearing.
Here we have an aircraft that is flying in a controlled airspace with an airborne control monitoring unit, another similar collector, another aircraft in the immediate area, constant radio checks back and forth. He reports one time that he's seen some tracers go by. This is at night, okay? And then we don't hear anything more from him. He fails to make a radio check. Pilots flying along in an area like that, and he takes anti-aircraft fire, he's going to say, I've been hit. Now, and if he's losing altitude or he's losing power, he's going to say, we're going to have to bail out. We're bailing out. You didn't get any of that. When you look at this picture, what you have is a plane that fell like a stone. Straight vertical dive down. It hit one time. It flipped over on its back and caught on fire. A C-47, my father flew in C-47s in World War II. That's an aircraft flew over the hump in the Himalayas. That's an aircraft that you don't get out of very easily in level flight, let alone a vertical dive in an aircraft that's lost its ability to fly. Four guys are wearing beepers. Everybody's wearing beepers. It's alleged here by Senator Smith that four guys could have gotten out of the aircraft.
I didn't allege anything. I used the facts. Okay. I used your radio messages. I didn't allege anything.
Well, I'm not sure where that came from. We're not able to find it. But let's just say four guys got out of the aircraft. They're all trained in escape, evasion, and rescue. They're all wearing beepers. One of the beepers maybe didn't work. Sure. Two, possible. Three, unlikely. All four, never heard from. Very unlikely. You know, if you look at the facts surrounding this case, I think you have to come to a position that it would have been extremely difficult for men to have bailed out of an aircraft that's falling vertically in increasing speed and impacts on the ground, flips over one time and burns.
Mr. Sheets, I don't dispute that. I'm not a flyer, but I don't dispute any of that. All I'm trying to point out is, in terms of analysis, let me just this way quickly. An EC-47 is lost in a given day, 5 February 1973. 45 minutes later, a radio transmission is received. Okay? There are no other aircraft in the area that have been lost in that period of time, in that 45-minute period of time. There are 4 bodies, 8 people on the aircraft. 4 bodies are recovered. 4 are not. All of the things you say make sense as far as whether people didn't get out, beepers. I don't dispute any of it. I'm just saying, when a question is asked, and we look at the facts, and a question is asked by a witness before this committee, is there any evidence? And you say no, I think that is very, very misleading, if not downright being dishonest with the committee.
I understand the senator's point.
And I think you have to express when we're an oversight committee. We're trying to find out how you analyze data. And when I see that kind of response to questions that I'm trying to analyze data, I frankly don't know what to believe or what to, right. When you guys. So all I'm saying to you is, you not only this is not simply a case here where you had no message. This was further than that. You got a message. You got a lot of activity on that message. It went all the way to Secretary Kissinger. That's how far that message went. So it may be beyond. So it was not, and people, as a matter of fact, in the Eagleburger memo, it went so far as to suggest that maybe we ought not to even continue with the bringing home of the American POWs and maybe want to consider resuming the war as a result of this and other information that has been coming up. So this is not a small matter. And for one individual analyst to say before this committee that he himself decides that this is not a valid message when everybody else disagrees, and then to you, all the stuff about the crash, if you didn't have the message, I don't dispute any of it, but you had a message, and you don't have any other aircraft missing in the area in that time frame, and you haven't explained it to me, and then you tell me, well, maybe if I go back, I could find somebody. 20 years later, that's a little late.
Sir, you've already...
Your master's very, you're good. I give you credit.
You have very articulate...
So when they make stuff up, it's amazing to the extent that we have discovered the extent and the depth of the things that they made up. And incidentally, you can see 23 personnel on the top. I wrote there, I actually, there are 23 personnel who made log entries about Baron 52 in these documents. Not one of those personnel were ever interviewed that I'm aware of as to why they made those entries and what it meant to them. Not one of them. One of them is a brigadier general on these documents. So when it comes to things that have been overlooked, I might suggest that aside from everything we're discussing here today and in future episodes, we have documentation to back up what we're saying. We're not just pulling this stuff out of our butts and making our stuff up. We don't do that. Mm-hmm. But people in official sworn testimony before the Senate Select Committee made things up and actually gave false testimony. So that's why we're doing these podcasts, mm-hmm. to let it be known out there for people who have no clue of what we know exists because we possess it, is contradicting the official Department of Defense file case. So we're not trying to blow smoke on this issue. We're coming across to let other people know, your listeners know, John B. This is serious stuff that has been overlooked. And with the help of Heather and Ralph and everybody here, my sister Mary, who actually attended the presentation in Washington, D.C. back in 2016, she's witness to what they told us they were going to do versus what they did not do. So,
yeah,
anyway, this brings up for everybody who's tuning in and listening to what we have to offer.
This brings up a good point right here. There was also a member of Joe's squadron, Colonel Lionel Blau, who gave an oral history interview back in 1989 in San Antonio. And I have a transcript of that oral history interview. and he's taught where him and Schofield were talking about the Baron 52 crash. And Colonel Blau, in his statements to the interviewer, was a Mr. Ellerson. Blau says, I'm just going to go through the transcript real quick. It says, Blau says, actually what happened is that I had some previous photographic interpretation experience before my tour over in Yubon. And when they told me that they had some film, I went to the 8th Tactical Fighter Wing intel shop where they had a photo interpreting equipment. They identified some C-47 wreckages, and I started going through those one at a time. And I came to this one and identified that as a new crash site. When they said, no, that's an old crash site, I had them come to check and show that it was a new crash site. Then Ellerson states, on the photo, though, it gives the exact geographic coordinates of where that crash site is located. And Blau says, yes, on our photo. He says, but at the time, that was just a strip of film, and we ran it through. Ellerson says, but I'm establishing for history, we know exactly from this photograph where the aircraft finally impacted. And Colonel Blau moved it here. Colonel Blau states, that is correct. And Blau says, but that was 3 or 4 days after the aircraft went down. We did not know exactly where the aircraft had gone down. We knew the general area, and we were looking in that general area and had requested that a fast fact go over and take pictures. One of the points, Blau says, one of the points that I always like to point out on these pictures is that it does not show the way the aircraft come into the crash site. When you look at the film, the footage that I looked at, it was very obvious that the aircraft had hit up on the hill and came directly in and impacted upside down. The wings were knocked off and part of the aircraft, it looked like to me the tail section was up on that hill. Ellerson says, how far away up on the hill? And Blau says, oh, I don't know, 400 yards or something like that. And Blau says, the thing that I think that is important is the aircraft nose was still on a direct line with that hill. He says, the reason that I think it's important to note where that tail section was or where that piece of fuselage was and where it hit up on the hill and its relative bearing with the nose of the aircraft is that determining that the individuals were KIA, Colonel Francis Humphreys, who was the 8th Tactical Fighter Wing commander at Yubon at the time, the main thing that he said would cause him to say they were KIA was that the aircraft was spinning and no one could get out of the aircraft. Blau says, I pointed out to him that the aircraft hit straight ahead and it was not spinning as far as he could tell. He totally disagreed with that as well as any other messages. So even Colonel Blau's testimony or his oral history interview points out to the fact that the aircraft hit up on the hill and it's just like what Ralph was saying. And that Humphreys totally disregarded most of all the evidence.
Yeah, I want to point out that I was not aware of that testimony when I began my look at it. Exactly. So mine was completely in isolation. I came up with the same thing.
Exactly.
And they overlooked a lot of things. And then we have to, in our minds, determine whether it was intentional or not. And I'm not even going to go there, but I will offer that when Mr. Destat gave his sworn testimony, my opinion is he was making things up. And when Senator Smith asked Mr. Destat directly, if those four air pirates in that message were not members of the Baron 52 crew, who were they? Mr. Destat said, and I think you're going to edit this excerpt into this podcast, John.
Correct.
He actually says, well, a friend of a friend of mine was an Arvin helicopter pilot, and he had crew aboard. They were shot down, and we believe those four air pirates were members of that crew. And then Senator Smith says, 20 years later, you're telling us that now? My question is, if in fact they didn't find out who those four air pirates were back then, and here it is 20 years later, and he's given sworn testimony using that same story, why did not anybody else definitively figure out if that story was true? Why wasn't Mr. DeStat followed up upon? Because he said to Senator Smith, we're trying to find that person.
The EC-47 was, because I think it relates to what we're trying to establish in terms of analysis, in terms of how you, and I use it as a case study to try to determine how you come to the conclusions that you come to. Now, that's the purpose of it. Now, when you say, and before the committee, at the last testimony, 91, whenever that date was, and you were here in July or whatever date it was, when you were asked if there's any evidence that anybody survived the EC-47 incident, and you say there is no evidence. Now, I'm just asking you, as a point of definition, why is a radio message not evidence?
If the radio message, in fact, referred to this crew, then it would be evidence. But this radio message has nothing to do with this particular crew.
Okay.
You're going to say why it has nothing?
Yeah. The assumption is that the only aircraft that were down, the only potential candidates for this were the crew of the EC-47 crew. Well, there in fact were at least three Arvin helicopters that were down in an area that would have caused the crew, if captured, to be evacuated through Ving at the approximate time frame that we acquired this particular piece of intelligence. And in fact, a personal friend of mine, who was a pilot in the Vietnamese Air Force, is aware of a friend of his who was the pilot of one of those helicopters. He is aware that that friend, in fact, was captured with his crew and was moved to North Vietnam. Now, we're in the process right now of trying to locate to determine if any member of that crew survived captivity and is here in the United States. And if I can find them, we may have an answer to who this message really refers to.
But the point is, at the time you drew this conclusion, you didn't have that information. So what I'm saying is there is no other aircraft missing. We discussed the one that went down and the people were killed. There's no other aircraft missing in the area like this. I'm not disputing any of the facts that you gave me, the outline that you gave me on the crash and what happened. I don't dispute those facts. I have no quarrel with any of that. But what I am trying to get at here is, you get a radio message. The message is self-explanatory. That's what it says. Then you start doing analysis on it. There's nothing about VIN in the message. There's nothing about VIN 240 miles away in the message. That's an analysis. That came later. The message itself speaks for itself. It says for
the initial message. You noted that the second version of that message contained a footnote. I feel confident that the version that you have the first version of that message.
I can't read it.
And it also contains a footnote. And that footnote from the people who issued the report said that it came from Vin.
I know.
In their judgment.
Wouldn't it have been more honest to say to the committee when we asked you if there was evidence, if anybody survived Baron 52 a few months ago when you testified, wouldn't it have been more honest to say we had a radio transmission? We didn't believe the radio transmission or whatever, but we think we also examined the crash site and we found that we didn't have that based on the people who were at the site. We don't think anybody survived. And here's why. You didn't say that. You said there's no evidence.
Implicit in your statement is the assumption that I don't believe this radio transmission. It's also implicit that there's confirmed evidence that
everybody else believed it.
Well, and as I pointed out earlier, as I noted earlier, that's a topic that I wish to address, and you know, as we progress through this, but I believe that radio transmission. It simply does not relate in any way to this particular incident. It does not relate to this EC-47 crew. It could possibly be. I don't know who it is, but it could possibly be. The crew members of one of those three Arvin aircraft helicopters. Now that's assuming.
Were they missing within 45 minutes of the time?
As I noted earlier, it's physically impossible. It strains credulity beyond what's reasonable to assume that any PAVN unit could have reached that crash site, captured those four people from that particular incident, and had a radio transmission confirming that passing through VIN 46 minutes after that that aircraft went down.
First of all, we don't know if they were at the crash. If they were at the crash and died, yes, but we didn't find any bodies, so we don't know if they parachute out because we didn't find any parachutes, so we don't know what happened to them. That's the point. We really don't know, and for you to say that there were other aircraft missing and you can't tell me who they are or how many people were on them, how many years later, 20 years later, you're telling me that there are other aircraft missing in that area and it was within that 45 minute period that this message was reported. I mean, that's outrageous.
Well, let me quote from the a letter written by the commander on the spot as to whether or not there was indications that people had bailed out of that. This man was much closer to the scene than I am from this location in time.
I'd like to know who the aircrafts were.
That's an example of him making stuff up to answer a direct question from a United States senator and give that answer under oath. Makes absolutely no sense.
I want to point out too, and I found that document of that helicopter that they were trying to do the comparison to, and that was like a week to 2 weeks later that helicopter was shot down. And the only thing that they had that they can compare the reference to four pirates to was a few days earlier in South Vietnam. There was an F-4 that was shot down and an OV-10 that was shot down, both from the same incident. And there was only actual one. One of the pilots, I can't remember if he was the Rio or if he was a pilot of the F-4 that survived. The other three were killed, either after they hit the ground or during the incident. So, and that one, I forget his name. The one POW, he ended up being released during Operation Homecoming a few weeks later.
I think we can go all day long about the things that were said in this testimony, that once you show the actual testimony, the actual footage that was C-SPAN test recordings, it clearly shows that Mr. Destat, in my opinion, and I would like to offer up to anybody else to formulate their own opinion as to whether or not he was making stuff up. Was he prepared to give the testimony that he actually gave, or was he not prepared? And if he was not prepared, he never should have been there. But he was there. And we're talking about American POWs left behind in Southeast Asia. And this case is just, we could say, a tip of the iceberg for so many other family cases that have similar parallel arguments about their family's family member's case that, and I've even heard this before, when they're asked a question, they just literally make stuff up. And we can prove that with this Senate Select Committee C-SPAN footage that you're going to edit into this podcast. We can prove it.
Yes.
One thing I'd like to add was after we met in, what was it, 2017 in Washington, and that all of that information was forwarded to DPAA and then eventually, supposedly, to the Air Force for a decision. When the decision came out, I contacted the interim director of DPAA, as well as the three-star general Gina Grosso, who is chief of manpower, personnel, and services at the Air Force, both of them involved in this, and asked them if they had a crash investigation expert, anybody from the safety office at the Air Force, take a look at what we presented. And both of them refused to answer my question. They just ignored it. They would not answer it, which tells me that they didn't have anybody look at it clearly, and nobody did. No respectable safety guy is going to agree with what they came up with. So that's been the process, you know. Just pull something out of your butt and send it out there, and we don't care whether it makes sense or not. And it's sad. It's sad because, like I say, we're talking about grieving families, promotions and financial stuff and all that kind of stuff that goes with it. It's serious business. Then they violated that big time for all these years and still doing it, still doing it.
Well, I might offer here and now that, and there's going to be more episodes from what I understand, John B. We're going to do some more episodes.
Yes.
And, we may have Senator Smith himself and former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, Dr. Roger Shields. He was in POW MIA portion. But I would like to offer right here and now that DPAA, if they are listening to this podcast, that they contact John B., John Bear, you see him there, and engage what we have alleged here, engage our assertions without sidestepping the answers to our assertions and speak to them directly. And if they don't, I might offer to your listening audience that, you know, it's not what people say. Sometimes it's more what they don't say. And if they remain silent, then I take inference that they have a reason to remain silent. And I would ask them to speak to that, to publicly be on this podcast and answer. And John can go back to this very podcast and edit some of this to when they appear on the podcast. So I challenge DPAA and the Secretary of the Air Force, because if you want me to name names of certain individuals that I feel have not fully answered the questions that we have, to own up to it and then come across so your listening audience can actually hear their side of the story. We're not trying to be one way about this at all. We are not. So again, I challenge DPAA and the Secretary of the Air Force to speak to these assertions, because I have a tape recording between myself and the Secretary of the Air Force, to which we discussed evidence that was overlooked during that telephone conversation, to which still to this day, neither the Secretary of the Air Force or DPAA has ever been able to explain to me why the Torreson documents were overlooked. And there's some serious assertions made by the researchers done, the research that they did for the Senate Select Committee, that have yet to be answered. So DPAA, if you're listening, Secretary of the Air Force, if you're listening, contact John Bear if you'd be kind enough. And you are invited to be on this podcast, and we'll discuss things. We'll discuss it. But you have to be upfront with us like we are being with you.
The following recording is 28 minutes long, and it is the conversation between Secretary of the Air Force, three-star Lieutenant General Grosso, to John Matijov on the 8th of November, 2016. It is the official phone call informing me of the final resolution from the Secretary of the Air Force on the status review of our brother, Sergeant Joseph Matijov, from the Baron 52 case.
Mr. Matijov, sir, is that you?
Yes. Is this Lieutenant General Grosso?
Yes, sir, it is. I want to thank you very much for your patience. I'm sorry that I was late today. And I know you've been waiting for an answer for a long time, so thank you for your patience.
Not at all.
I did want to let you know, I have several folks with me here today, just so you know. I've got my exec, Major Ron Cheatham, and of course, Ms. Tamara Newton, who I think you've met, Mr. H.L. Larry, who are my experts on this, Dr. Todd Ford, who is my new deputy, and Mr. Robert Williams, who is our legal advisor, and as well as Major Lewis, who is a public affairs person.
Okay.
So I just wanted you to know who you're talking to, so you're not surprised. You know, first I want to share with you that obviously the DPAA analyst spent some time working on this to try to make sure that we gave you, we properly evaluated all of the information that you provided. And I spent a lot of time reading all of the information, and I can attest that I did slow this down, frankly, because it was something that's very new to me. It was a lot of information provided, but given it's such an important decision for you and your family, I wanted to make sure that I did the best I could to make the right decision, and then to make that recommendation to the Secretary of the Air Force, because I would never want to, obviously, for respect for you and for respect for her, make a decision that I wasn't totally informed on.
Sure.
But I do have to tell you, after the thorough assessment from the analyst from DPAA, my thorough reading of all the information you provided, all of the folks, all of the, my staff and the staff going up to the Secretary of the Air Force, I have determined there's no basis to re-examine or disturb the original 1973 KIA determination. And I regret to say that because I know how important this is to you, and I can certainly understand why it's so important to have the remains of your brother. But unfortunately, we just don't believe there's any new information at this time to be able to reverse the original decision.
Okay, of course, I'm a little bit disheartened to hear that. My immediate question would be, and I don't know if you're equipped to provide the answer at this very second, but what is the explanation of the Torsen documents and the separate accounting system that those documents state that the Defense Intelligence Agency had a separate recording or accounting system indicating four of the Baron 52 crew members were actually captured, and then in 1974, in February 1974, they changed the status to captured, died in captivity. What is the explanation for that if they swore under testimony, they being Bob Bestad and the Defense Intelligence Agency, swore at the Senate Select hearings that they all died in the crash? I do not understand how that gross of a different fact, I call those both facts because they did occur, how can they not be explained away with what you just told me? There's no basis to establish or redetermine a review of the case.
I understand that the DPA and analysts have provided you a direct answer to that, but I can tell you my assessment from reading all of the documents.
Forgive the interruption, and I apologize for it, but no, DPAA has not provided me a response to that. That's one of my concerns. DPAA, Mr. Todd Livick, actually wrote to a senator that when we asked that through a conversation to that senator, and he talked to Mr. Todd Livick. We got it in writing from Mr. Todd Livick, who I understand was handling matters after Mike Linnington left his post. His response to that whole question was simply, KK status means captured, died in captivity. That's all he said. He did not analyze it. DPAA, as far as I am concerned, did not analyze it. And of course, you understand now why I'm troubled with your comment that DPAA has already provided me that information. They have not. Maybe I misunderstood you, and I apologize for that. But did you not say that DPAA provided me with that information?
My understanding is that was provided to you through the senator, but I have not seen that. So if that's incorrect, that is my apologies on that. That's just what I was informed of.
Well, and this is the problematic concerns about this entire case. The bureaucracy is so large, the tentacles are so outreaching to nowhere, that the left hand, forgive me, doesn't even know what the left hand is doing. And here's an example of it. One of the most crucial bits of new evidence that we submitted during the 5 February 2016 presentation were those Torsen documents. And Mr. Linnington told me, told my family, told all of our attorneys and the congressional staff present in the room that day that he would look into everything. And I found out, and I have the document signed by Mr. Livick, that KK status simply means
captured, died in captivity. There was no correlation as to the meaning or the analyzation of that accounting process that was totally 180 degrees out from the sworn testimony that the Defense Intelligence Agency offered to the POW-MIA Senate Select Committee. So I will offer to you, ma'am, that this question and that new evidence has not been reviewed or analyzed to the benefit of my brother's status.
I'm looking at the report, which we will mail to you. We just didn't want to send it to you. We wanted to talk to you first. But there is an explanation of the use of KK and how loosely it was used early on, and that it wasn't as black and white as being purported in your evidence.
This will just raise more questions to you than I know. We do not have the time with everybody assembled to debate this right now, but I will raise this question to you before we hang up this phone. Until someone explains to me who in the Defense Intelligence Agency placed anybody from the Baron 52 crew into a captured status and why, I am not going to accept any resolution that no basis to establish a or redetermine a status review is warranted, because you find that everything has been looked into when you and I are discussing the very fact that this particular issue has not been analyzed to the fullest extremes in which it is beneficial to both you and to my brother. You have not explained to me as graciously as you attempted to that it was vague. Someone in the Defense Intelligence Agency placed four of those crew members into a captured status. Is that vague or not vague?
No, sir, that is very clear. So I will give you a direct answer to that. I don't want to hold up the letter, so I'm going to send you the letter with the assessment, but I will give you a direct answer to that quickly.
And then it further reads, on page 33 of the Torreson documents, this is no conjecture on my part, this is not very vague, that there were two documents, the Torreson documents and, quote, an Air Force document pending declassification, indicating that this information and this total parallel accounting system that the Defense Intelligence Agency had was contradicting the official file report. No one has been able to explain, and again, I might be repeating myself, but I think it warrants my repetition here. You cannot, and have not been briefed, in my opinion, as to where the disconnect was made, who made it, and how to this very moment on this telephone conversation, it still remains a mystery. I am blown away by that, and I appreciate your attempt to explain it, and I do appreciate your words that you will have to send the package. You don't want to hold the package up, but this only continues the matter, and I wish that my attorney had been able to make it to the phone today, because he would be taking notes as I am taking notes, and this just inflames the whole case, in my opinion, further still, because when I am told by the President of the United States that I must go to the Defense or to the Department of Defense and DPAA to handle this situation, I wrote the Bush administration twice, I wrote the Obama administration twice, I was sent to the DPAA for them to do what they did. We did that. I even took the time. I waited a full year for the newly organized DPAA to stand up in order to present our case, and I did that. So I did everything I was told, and at the presentation, I was told everything would be looked into, only to find right now that it wasn't. We presented evidence, and it was not looked into. Now, if I go to the President of the United States, who directs me to your level, the DPAA, and we go through all of this process, only to get back to square one, when nothing has been done to the new evidence that we were allowed to submit, I must ask you, who do I go to now? Because because the regulations are not being followed, new evidence has not been analyzed, and we're back to square one. After 25 years of my pursuing this, I'm back to zero. Can you understand my frustration?
Oh, yes, sir, I do, absolutely. I believe that was analyzed. I just can't get you an answer off the top of my head. So give me a chance to get you the answer, because it was analyzed. And then we can have another discussion.
I appreciate that. It just alarms me, as I'm sure you are alarmed, that what I have been able to tell you from Story, Wyoming, that it was not, and you're telling me it was, but not able to give me that analysis, as important and strategic as that bit of new evidence is, you are unaware of what the analysis is, because if anything is a smoking gun document concerning the Baron 52 case, those Torreson documents are, and in my opinion, and I think I'm entitled to one, that should be rolling off the tips of everybody's tongue as to what happened there, because it is so egregiously wrong and incorrect, and the two dots between the two are so vague, never going to be connected until I have something in writing that explains to me how that Defense Intelligence Agency can run the separate accounting process that totally contradicted their sworn testimony to a Senate congressional hearing. This makes absolutely no sense to me, and I hope every ear that's in your office listening to my words thinks in the back of his or her head, he might have a point here. And I think I do. And I have attorneys, and I have congressional representatives whom I also believe will make it a point. And I'm not trying to be aggressive with you in nature right now, but I think you fully comprehend my frustration level right now.
Yes, sir, I do. I'm just taking some notes so I get this right.
And ask me any question, because I can back up anything I say. I don't throw the BS anywhere. I never have in this process. I've always been honest with everybody. I've always been patient with everybody. I've done what I've been directed to do, only to find that it's been for no good reason, considering this very conversation that just came across this phone line into my home. There has been no proper analysis done if those Torreson document explanations have not been given to you. And with the warning, you need to understand that this is a key bit of new evidence, and you need to understand why it's good or bad. I am blown away that you are not aware of those documents and the analysis to be able to discuss that very thing with me today, considering a negative decision.
Sure, there were a lot of things in those documents, so I think there were, if I had known that was the key, there were many things in that document from reading that, that I learned from reading them, so I just can't hone in on this, but if it turns out after another review we haven't, but I'm almost certain, because I remember an explanation of that, it's just not coming to my mind, that getting this through the secretary after looking at it myself, I reread a lot of it.
I appreciate what you're trying to tell me, but I'm going to reiterate what I said. If, in fact, those documents indicate that sworn testimony was not genuine, it was false, and we presented that with the only source document that gave us that indication being the Torreson documents, I am still going to hold on to my initial comments that there is no reasonable explanation for you not to have the answer to why they were not analyzed with an appropriate dose of common sense for me to digest this very phone call. That makes no sense to me at all, and between you and I, ma'am, I may not be on top of the food chain, but I'm far from being at the bottom of it. And I'm going to very graciously offer that to you. I almost feel, and I don't want to turn this phone call sour, I feel a little bit insulted that no one on the other end of this phone or anybody assembled in that room today can come up to you and put a note and say, here's the explanation. With all the work and all the effort and all the people who were involved in this complicated case, we can, I can, and anybody else who hears this case can go, are you kidding me? You have those documents that indicate what you just said, and you don't have the explanation for it. This makes no sense to me, simply from a common sense standpoint. I'm sorry, there's no other way I can look at that, unless you can tell me something else in the next 10 seconds that changes that opinion.
Well, I would just say, sorry, please don't. I hope I in no way was disrespectful to you, because
no,
I was very respectful for what you're doing.
No, you're only doing, and you know, I was in the military. And you're only as good as the people you're surrounded by. You know that more than I do. However, you have been given a rather low support base on that issue and those Torreson documents, even after I sent a specific email to Tamara Newton concerning those very documents. I elevated them to the skyline for everybody to tear apart, openly trying to understand how they could even exist and not have an explanation. I brought them to the skyline requesting they be looked at, and still no one can tell me the answer after I did all what I did. Let's not even talk about all the other new evidence that was presented in the two-hour PowerPoint on the 5th of February 2016. I'm not saying it all comes down to the Torreson documents, but until someone can reasonably explain to all of us on our side of the fence, and I'm dividing right now. I'm on one side of the fence, and all of the people assembled in that room right now are on the other side of the fence. And I'm saying right now that those tours
are scheduled to be broken down automatically in three.
I'm sorry. Hello?
Minutes. To extend the time, please signal for an operator.
Are you still there?
Yes, sir. We're still here.
I don't know what just happened. Something about 3 minutes extension, but I don't know if you heard everything I saw. I said, but again.
Yes, sir. I did.
Okay. You can I don't want to repeat myself. I already have. You can sense everything that I hope, not in a disrespectful way, back to you or anybody assembled in that room. But if you or me, knowing what I know. And I don't hide anything. I never have. I'm just blown away that you do not have an explanation for those Torreson documents ready at your fingertips to provide to me over the phone today, considering the negative decision that you had to give me over the phone. I just don't know what to say. I think I've said it.
I understand. So we'll take another attempt. And I will get you the letter in the mail, and then we'll continue the dialogue.
And thank you. And I also talked to Mr. Lennington. He, of course, and I agreed with this, he says, I can't tell you what our recommendation is until I hear you got the final notification. And I said, well, will I get your analysis and your package? And he said, well, I'm sure the Air Force will give it to you. Of course, you're going to say, well, we're not DPAA, but I'm assuming you possess it, and I'm assuming you can, that's another request I will cordially convey to you right now. I would like to receive everything that DPAA submitted to you as far as their recommendation and their analysis. And between you and me, I'm going to go right to the paragraph, wherever it may be, from the DPAA side of the house to find out what was done about the Torreson documents from Mr. Mike Linnington's direction. And
so we have that's actually attached to the letter, and we will FedEx that out tomorrow.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. And again, it all hones in on the Torreson documents. And then everything else falls into place after that analysis is either explained or otherwise someone is held responsible. That's what it boils down to. If it's explained, it has to be a plausible common sense explanation. And I don't care if it's the Defense Intelligence Agency not wanting to give up information. I would assume, as Secretary of the Air Force, as a member of the Air Force, the one document on the Torreson documents, page 33, it says an Air Force document pending declassification. That was on that page. in 1992 and submitted to the Senate Select Committee. Here it is, 2016. I'd be curious, and I'm requesting it right now, where is that Air Force document that in 1992 was pending declassification as referenced in the Torsen documents? Because if Mr. Torsen is still alive, you best believe he's about to be pursued and interviewed about those documents. If you don't do it, you know I have attorneys who will. Because I have to. And if you were me, I don't think you would have any other recourse.
Yes, sir. I understand.
Okay, I'm going on and on and on, and again, I apologize if I don't mean to raise my voice, but you can certainly sense my frustration.
Yes, sir, I do. My father served in Vietnam twice, so I am very empathetic, and I'm sorry for the loss of your brother.
Well, I appreciate those thoughts, and I appreciate your telling me about your dad's service. And, you know, as you know, my family has 100 years of combined active duty military service. 2 West Point grads, a Silver Star winner. We got one kid who's serving in the Navy nuclear submarine program as we speak. So you're talking a military legacy on this side of the house that does not deserve to have this type of analysis done on a family member lost in combat. And
yes, sir, I understand. So we owe you more.
I'd like to think that you do, and I'm going to call you on that, ma'am, and I think you understand I have to.
Yes, sir. So you'll get the, we'll get the FedEx out tomorrow, given it's a holiday Friday. I don't know if you get it Friday or Monday, but you should see that soon. And then we'll get you a direct answer on the DIA documents.
And I truly appreciate that. And forgive me, I have to say this. And I know you're going to be a little embarrassed, and you're going to think I'm yanking your chain when I say this. I don't need a duplicate copy of Mr. Livick's explanation that KK status meant captured, died in captivity. I could not believe that's what he gave as far as the response was to a United States senator and walked away from that, and the senator did not say, are you kidding me? I just don't get that. So if that's what you're going to give me, kindly understand I will not accept that. I want an explanation of the dots and how they haven't been connected, and if they are connected, someone has to explain them away and be held accountable for the very indication that those documents tell us all, that they didn't die in the plane crash, they were captured alive. And that's the explanation that I need to be explained. How can that be after sworn testimony was otherwise, that they died in the crash?
I understand, sir.
Thank you very much for your time and your patience with me. Again, I did not mean to raise my voice with you, but you get it. I think you get it, you know, and I hope everybody else in that room, thank you all for being assembled today, but this is just the beginning. This is just the very beginning.
Okay, sir.
It clearly shows my own frustration during the conduct of that phone conversation when I realized that Lieutenant General Grosso had no clue of my assertions about the Torsen documents when we, on pages 52 to 56 of the file that our lawyers used to brief Department of Defense personnel, it discusses the Torsen documents. Not one analyst, not one functional team that DPAA claims they use to analyze our evidence. No one from the Secretary of the Air Force, when they said they looked at everything, they did not look at the Torsen documents. And no one has been able to explain that to me, or anybody else for that matter.
And it wasn't just Torsen's documents either. It was also Lang, that was also an investigator that had pointed out.
He paralleled the same responsibilities that Cedric Torsen did, and they both had similar comments. That Baron 52 needed more answers to be delivered in order to figure out why the Defense Intelligence Agency had separate files pertaining to prisoners of war, whether they were captured or killed. And Baron 52's prisoners were considered to have been captured and then died in captivity, according to the DIA. But no one has been called to the table no one has been called out to explain those parallel documents held within Defense Intelligence Agency that both Lange and Torreson documented in their research with files given to the Senate Select Committee. The Senate Select Committee didn't even.
You might point out how those files work. It lists the status of all missing in actions and whatnot. And in the case of Byron 52, there are two letters there, KK, which those two letters signify captured, died in captivity. Now, one might claim maybe that's a typo, you know, the administrator made a mistake. But at the bottom of that page is annotation that says that this determination is in conflict with the Air Force position. So whoever put that in knew exactly what he was putting in, and he knew it differed from the Air Force position. So we have our own intelligence agency. Now, those guys have amazing stuff. So how they determined they were captured and died in captivity tells you a little bit of something. They got somebody in there, because they would not say died in captivity unless they knew they had some intelligence to that effect, that, you know, they got up into Russia or wherever, which is probably where they took them, by the way, because when you capture people with electronic warfare technology, whether they be backseaters of the F-105F or ECU-47Q crew members, they're high-tech people. They go to Russia, and they get fully interrogated, and they suck every bit of information out of them. So somebody knew that they had been, whatever, interrogated and then killed, and DIA figured that out. So where and why and how, and, you know, how long were they captured, questions that need to be answered. But DPA wants no part of it.
The only other thing I'll add, John, is that your research recently came up with some CIA documents.
Yes.
Pertaining to the Baron 52 crew. And the most egregious one even shocked me, and I'd never seen it before until you found it, to which it was a daily presidential briefing to the President of the United States. While it did not mention Baron 52 in those words, it did mention the four Americans. And this briefing, this daily brief given to the President of the United States, if my memory is correct, John, it was June of 1973.
Four. Yes. 1974, John.
Was it 74?
Yes.
A year later. A year later. And then Nixon resigned in August of that year, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep. Yes.
So why is the CIA briefing the President of the United States in 1974 about the four Americans? Dr. Roger Shields will tell us that if there was ever any case that he was concerned about premature assignment of killed in action status, it was Baron 52. That researcher Lang said the same thing, as did Sedgwick Torreson, the same thing. Baron 52, those four crew members from Baron 52 have raised the eyebrows of some very significant people, to which we now know a CIA document briefed the President of the United States on the four Americans. We're going to assume, and I'm going to assert right now that, and maybe you can show that document, John, when you put this all together, you can show where the President of the United States was actually briefed a year later in June of 1974.
Soars above our land, flags so proudly hailed. Be proud of this America. Realize we failed to bring our MIA's America. be waiting for. Bring them home, bring them home. Eagle flies in chains till we have.